Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party and Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to educate and advocate for the eco-socialist program that Angela Walk and I ran on. And I'm bundled up because it's cold in here. It's cold in Syracuse, and this storefront doesn't warm up too much. And I didn't have heat at home, and I got a cold. So I'm just staying bundled up. But there's plenty to talk about. Let's start again with Gaza. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said on Thursday in a press conference that he will not succumb to U.S. pressure to end the Gaza war, and he won't accept the two-state solution, which Biden has been pushing. Quote, in any future settlement, Israel will control all the land from the river to the sea. Now, there are two translations about that last phrase. This is according to I-24 News, which is a mainstream Israeli news channel. You probably have it on your cable if you have cable. And of course, pro-Palestinian marchers are accused by the right of anti-Semitism and promoting genocide when they chant from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, which is Rashida Tlaib, the only Palestinian member in Congress, said, you know, is an aspiration for a land that's free from the river to the sea for everybody, not just Palestinians, or it's not about getting rid of the Israelis. But she was censured by the House of Representatives for defending that slogan. But that just shows how out of touch our political leaders in the House are. And there wasn't much pushback against Netanyahu for saying the same thing. So, you know, it just shows a double standard. The other translations has him saying Israel must control all the land west of the Jordan River, which amounts to the same thing. But by either translation, it's clear that Netanyahu is for a one-state solution from the river to the sea, with the one state being for Israelis and no state for Palestinians. You know, and at this point, I mean, that was a direct rebuke of Biden. What's it going to take him to change course on the unconditional support the U.S. has given to Israel? Yeah, Biden officials say they want to end the mass killing of Palestinian civilians, and they want to start a political process toward a two-state solution. But we got to look at what they do, which is they continue to deliver arms to Israel and provide blanket diplomatic support at the United Nations. And last week in their dismissal as quote-unquote meritless, South Africa's genocide charge before the International Court of Justice. You know, well, they say meritless, but guess what? South African lawyers are now putting together a suit against the U.S. and the U.K. before the International Court of Justice for complicity in Israel's genocide of the Palestinians. So you know, you can say it's meritless, but it's about to come bite them. After Netanyahu said this, the next day, Friday, yesterday, Netanyahu said, and this was the first conversation they've had in a month. So, you know, you wonder, Biden says he's putting pressure on, but they aren't even talking. And according to Biden, Netanyahu would accept a demilitarized Palestinian state. In other words, a Bantustan for Palestinians who would have no control over their own land, at least on the military side. So, so much for Biden pressuring Netanyahu on reducing civilian casualties and moving toward a two-state solution. We need a fundamental change in U.S. policy. So we got to stay out there demanding the ceasefire and a political process toward a solution to this problem, which has been going on for decades and decades. The other thing to think about is this has become a regional war, maybe not a full-scale war, but the U.S. and Ansar Allah, which is, you know, what the Houthis really are. Houthis is the ethnic group that is predominantly in this Ansar Allah, which means servants of God. It's an Islamist fundamentalist group, but the U.S. and Ansar Allah are firing missiles at each other. So there's another front in the war. Israel and Hezbollah are exchanging fire in Lebanon and northern Israel. Iranian-backed militias in Syria and Iraq are exchanging fire with U.S. troops based in those countries. The rationale for the U.S. troops is to fight the Islamic State. They're there at the permission of Iraq, and in Syria, they're there at the invitation of the autonomous region that the Kurds organized, but is now actually majority Arab. They have expanded the area of self-administration, grassroots democracy, emphasizing cooperatives, equal rights for women. It's the most progressive. Man, this, what do you call this woman on the phone? That she's talking back to me. I'm sorry about that. That the U.S. troops are there, but their mission is not to defend that autonomous region. It's to clean up what remains of the Islamic State. But Turkey is using the diversion of the Gaza war to increase its attacks on those leftist Syrian rebels in northeastern Syria. They used to call it Rojava. That was a Kurdish word. Now they just call it the autonomous region in northeastern Syria. And Turkey's also attacking progressive Kurds in northern Iraq. So, you know, there's more conflict going on there. And Russia is using the Gaza war as a cover for increased airstrikes against Syrian rebels in northwestern Syria. Israel continues its airstrikes against Iranian militias in Syria with the permission of Russia in western Syria and the U.S. in eastern Syria, which control those respective airspaces. And then we got the Islamic State bombing that commemoration for the Iranian Revolutionary Guard leader Qasem Soleimani that was assassinated by the U.S. under Trump. And Pakistan responded by, Iran responded by attacking an Islamic State base in Pakistan. And then Pakistan responded again toward Iran. And now both Iran and Pakistan are attacking Balochistan separatist groups in both countries, which is a whole nother issue. There's a nationality, the Balochs, who have wanted independence, and they're split between Pakistan and Iran. So there are a lot of problems in this region, and there's a lot of armed conflict going on. But the precipitating factor is Israel's war in Gaza. And so the first step in bringing about peace in this region is to get a ceasefire in Gaza. And as I've said, the U.S. has leverage over Israel if it's willing to play hardball with it. So far, it's not. But that's why we must keep demanding a ceasefire for which U.S. support is essential to get Israel to accept in the dynamics of the international community. So meanwhile, the carnage in Gaza is unspeakable. It's not just the bombing. It's the lack of food and water and medicine, the disease that's spreading. Most people, 85% is a figure I've heard, don't have a shelter. They're in tents at best. It's a genocide unfolding before us, and we've got to do everything we can to stop it. And that starts with the ceasefire demand. The other thing I want to talk about before we get to questions and comments is ballot access suppression. We had a story out this week, No Labels, the centrist third party group, filed a complaint on January 11th with the Justice Department to investigate what it calls unlawful intimidation by groups that oppose it. And that's mainly Democrats. And so No Labels accused a number of political figures of engaging in voter suppression and in violating federal law, including the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, or RICO. No Labels, their spokesperson, the Black civil rights guy, Benjamin, blanking on his name. Well, he compared what is happening to No Labels to what the Ku Klux Klan did in the 50s and 60s to intimidate Black voters. And you know, the Greens are experienced with this. We should have thought of filing a complaint with the Justice Department a long time ago. Among the prominent people pushing this thing that No Labels is complaining about is Rick Wilson, who's a former Republican campaign operator and a founder of the anti-Trump Republican group, the Lincoln Project, Jonathan Last of the Bulwark, conservative news outlet, and Matt Bennett of Third Way, which is a centrist Democratic group. So, you know, the effort to keep no labels off is bipartisan, but they're mostly Biden supporters, the never Trump Republicans and the centrist Democrats who support no labels. And the tactics that no labels objected to included economic warfare against their supporters and donors, threatening them with the loss of clients and contracts, and searching private records for embarrassing details of these donors and supporters. There's a group called American Bridge, which is the Democratic Party's primary opposition research organization these days, has a budget of tens of millions of dollars, and it's hired the Democrats' top election lawyer, Mark Elias, to challenge No Labels ballot access petitions. And not only No Labels, he's definitely going after the Greens because he has in the past. You know, Elias has a pro-democracy reputation because he defeated Donald Trump in 64 court cases that promoted Trump's big lie that he won the 2020 presidential election. But in reality, Mark Elias believes in the Democratic Party, not democracy as such. He was John Kerry's lawyer in 2004 in that presidential election, and he oversaw the legal assault on Ralph Nader's ballot access. Nader's ballot access was attacked by 53 law firms and 90 lawyers who filed 24 lawsuits in 18 states, along with 5 complaints to the Federal Elections Commission, all within a 12-week period between June and September. And Toby Moffitt, who was a former congressman and then a corporate lawyer who coordinated Kerry's anti-Nader campaign, said publicly the purpose of the lawsuits was to drain Nader's campaign of resources. It was harassment. A lot of these lawsuits had no merit, but you have to go to court to defend yourself. Richard Winger of Ballot Access News, who knows about ballot access probably more than anybody in the country, calls that attack on Nader by far the most extensive campaign of ballot access suppression in American history. Mark Elias' law firm was behind the successful Democratic Party efforts that got my campaign knocked off the ballot in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Montana. He was behind the dirty tricks that Democrats used in North Carolina to try and get Matthew Hoh, the Green Party candidate for US Senate, off the North Carolina ballot. And those dirty tricks included harassing petition signers by phone, text, and front door visits to remove their names. Excuse me. And in a number of documented cases, these harassers misrepresented themselves as Green Party members or election board officials. And those are crimes of fraud, and they should have been prosecuted. But of course, they weren't by the Democratic officials who were falsely accusing the Matthew Hoh campaign of submitting a fraudulent petition. And they investigated. They didn't find anything. So No Labels will certainly receive legal challenges to its ballot access by Elias. It has $60 million, No Labels does. So they'll be able to defend themselves, but we can be sure that Elias is going to be going after the Green Party ballot access petitions, and going to court to defend ourselves is certainly going to stretch our resources. So if you're doing ballot access in your state, take care to make sure you do all the paperwork accurately and on time, and be ready for trivial harassment challenges at boards of election or state boards of election and in the courts. And we'll put in the chat links to a Reuters article about, it's called Biden Allies Plot to Thwart Third Party Bids That Threaten His Re-Election. And then an article I wrote about 18 months ago called The Democrats' Third Party Massacres, which goes into what they did to Nader and Matthew Hoh and many other cases where the Democrats are not so damn Democratic. So I'll stop there. I can't talk too much with this cold, so let's get your questions and comments. Ashley R., voter suppression is disgusting. However, suppressing a split or an apathy vote is imperative to stopping Project 2025 coming from tuition. Well, there's a contradiction there. Project 2025 is an anti-democratic project, and I don't think you defeat enemies of democracy by suppressing democracy. You got to present the case to voters that your candidate is better than Trump, which isn't hard to do, although Biden's having a hard time doing it. Jack Lucas, what's the perspective of Israeli Greens on the war on Gaza? I haven't looked at this in a while, but I think to the extent there was a Green Party movement in Israel, they went into the Meretz Party, which is a left party, which failed to pass the threshold of 3.25% in the last parliamentary elections to the Knesset. So they are regrouping. And the left in Israel is in really bad shape. The right and the religious right has really gained the upper hand. Although, if you look at polls, I think the country's pretty much split between the more liberal elements that don't agree with the far right on its social conservatism or its support for Netanyahu's effort to capture the judiciary. So you create a really authoritarian state. But they've got to regroup. And I'm not up on the details of that. Netanyahu public opinion polls say he has 15% support. He's continuing this war to stay in power. He faces criminal charges for bribery and various forms of corruption. I mean, it's a lot like Trump. So that's one motivation for him to keep the war going. But whether it's the Greens or some other element on the left in Israel, I wish them the best and, we should support them. Most of the progressive activity is movements, for, cooperation with the Palestinians toward a political solution and in resisting the Israeli oppression of Palestinians. But that hasn't translated into political party form very much. There's an Arab party. There's a party that has communist roots, it's called Hadash, I believe, and they have some representatives in the Knesset, but they are getting suspended and threatened with expulsion because they oppose the war in Gaza. So it's very difficult for the left in Israel right now. Frankie Lee, what do you think it will take to get Netanyahu to stop? I think getting him out of power. And it's not just the left in Israel. It's the center right or even the right that's not extreme fascist right. They don't like Netanyahu. And I think, they've got the knives out for him. They're just looking for the right time. The problem is during this war, they're closing ranks behind the war effort. But I think Netanyahu's time is limited. Okay, so you get Netanyahu out of there, but you still have the Israeli right to contend with. And they are in no mood to accommodate the Palestinians at all, which means it's going to take international pressure. And the U.S. is the linchpin there because we're powerful and we have given diplomatic and military support unconditionally to Israel for so long. So that's the key. I mean, we are in the place where we can make a difference, and we've just got to really keep pushing. The demonstrations have been good. We got to keep writing to our representatives in Congress. Ralph Nader put together or instigated a letter where we demanded that Elise Stefanik, who's a New York House of Representatives representative, who went after those college presidents with, it was a trap. They kind of fell into it. I don't think they handled themselves well, but she was stirring up stuff, not dealing with the real issues. So we called on her to resign. And there's an article out today. I think the headline is from the Watertown Times, which is in Stefanik's district. New York Green Party, Ralph Nader, Howie Hawkins called for Stefanik to resign. And hopefully that helps a little bit. We got to keep doing that. Nader's good at figuring out how to get attention, and this letter got some. But letters to the editor, particularly smaller newspapers, they're looking for content. You write a decent letter, it's going to get published. And people read that. After the obituaries, letters to the editors what gets read the most in those newspapers. So op-eds, public education, go to hearings, any forum you can find. And we just got to keep the pressure up. I mean, the U.S., I think, is the linchpin in this whole crisis. And don't underestimate how difficult it's going to be. We've got really since Johnson, you know, it's been unconditional support for Israel, with a few exceptions during the first Bush administration. James Baker, you know, drew some lines against Israel expanding the settlements in order to get agreement on something else. But it was very limited. And, you know, that's what we got to start doing. You know, stop giving them diplomatic cover in the UN General Assembly and in other forums. Like, you know, we gave them diplomatic cover by calling the South African genocide lawsuit meritless. And as I said, well, you know, the South Africans are coming after the U.S. next for complicity in that genocide. So that's what I think it'll take. It'll take a movement in this country that forces the U.S. government to change course. And that's a big job. But that's, I think, what it'll take. Ashley R., voting third party or sitting out in a swing vote is literally a tactic vote for Trump by default. Biden sucks, so demand more from him before it's too late. Yeah, I'm afraid it's too late. I mean, Bernie Sanders and the squad gave Biden their support without making any demands. Most of the progressive groups, a couple of labor unions are holding back. The Teamsters, the UAW, I'm not sure what they want from Biden, but, you know, that's what should be being done by progressives who want to support Biden, but they're not doing it. You know, in fact, Chris was looking at Biden's website before we went on air and said, you know, the first homepage is, you know, Trump's leading in the Republican primary. And I guess there's a donation page and a merchandise page. No platform, no program, no policies, no, you know, no statement about what Biden will do in his second term. I mean, you can't beat Trump with nothing. You got to give people a better option. So, you know, I put it back on Biden. And, you know, technically, and this is just a matter of math, if you vote for, say, Jill Stein, you're not voting for Trump. It's in the Stein column. It's not in the Trump column. It's not in the Biden column either. And some people assume, well, Stein voters would vote for Biden if Stein wasn't on the ballot. Well, we did have an exit poll. It's the only time this poll has been done on third-party candidates in 2016. And they asked supporters of Jill Stein and Gary Johnson, the Libertarian, well, if your candidate wasn't on the ballot, who would you vote for? 61% of Stein's voters said they would have stayed home. 25% would have voted for Clinton and 14% for Trump. I think the percentage would have stayed home for Gary Johnson was 54%, and the split between Clinton and Trump was more even. But the point is, you know, there are a lot of people out here, count myself among them, who want to vote for what we want, like Medicare for all and a Green New Deal. And if you don't vote for what you want, you're never going to get it. Nobody knows you want Medicare for all or a Green New Deal if you vote for Joe Biden. So your vote is your voice, and you know, some of us choose to use it, not just give it away to somebody who opposes everything we stand for. And I'll grant you, Trump is worse than Biden, but Biden's pretty bad, too. I mean, this border stuff. I mean, Biden handed the Republicans a gun to shoot him with when he linked the foreign aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan to border reform, immigration reform, and the Republicans are, you know, demanding the maximum of their, you know, draconian immigration policies, these cruel immigration policies, in order to get the other stuff. And they don't really want the other stuff. They don't even really want immigration reform. They just want to, you know, make Biden look bad so it'll help them in the 2024 election. You know, if this border crisis, they say it's an invasion, it's a big crisis. Well, if it was, they'd do something instead of holding out for something that is unpopular, even in their own caucus, and not let alone speak of the Democrats. But, you know, what they're holding out for is ending asylum, ending humanitarian parole for people coming from conflict areas like Ukraine or Syria or Afghanistan until they can have a hearing. They just want to start deporting people for whatever reason. And, you know, that's not what the United States is about. You know, Statue of Liberty, give us your tired, your hungry, your, what is it, masses yearning to be free. Well, we're contradicting that. With the policies we have now, and the Republicans, with the Democrats' complicity, want to make them worse. I mean, that's such a mean-spirited policy. I mean, it's hard to even say it's lesser evil, you know, when Biden's willing to agree to that stuff. Ashley R. Howie, so vote for him and then impeach him, but don't help the Nazi have another chance like 2016. Project 2025 is going to be the literal death of the left. Are you a leftist or not? Well, they can do what they want in terms of repression and so forth. It's not going to change who I am. And I grant you, you know, what the Republicans are proposing to do in terms of the unitary authoritarian executive, i.e. the president, gutting regulations. I mean, we got a Supreme Court case coming up on that, and on and on and on. But, you know, the Democrats had a chance in 2021 and 2022. They had both houses of Congress, and they didn't get the Voting Rights Act passed. Their number one priority, H.R. 1. Because they wouldn't take on the filibuster, which historically has been the way these Southern racist Dixiecrats have prevented civil rights and other progressive legislation. And instead, Biden wants to do bipartisanship with the party that tried to overthrow him. It's, you know, I just think we can't rely on the Democrats to fight the right. We got to have our own independent movement. And, you know, the presidential election is just one aspect of that. We should be running a lot more candidates down ballot and, you know, get some institutional power. At the local level, we got 141 or 42 elected officials. We should be getting into state legislatures and then the House of Representatives. And then we'll have a lot more credibility to present our point of view. And, you know, some of the progressive Democrats are going to adapt to us because, you know, some of them really want to go that way. They just feel limited within the Democratic Party. So, you know, if we can get that foothold in the legislatures, it'll make a big difference. Vicky Corden, I think Trump won Iowa because of voter apathy. Most people stayed home. Yeah, but the Trump people have energy. They have a lot of energy. And even though, you know, it was terrible weather and, you know, caucus and primary votes are low, I don't know how it stacked up historically in terms of voter turnout. The other thing was everybody knew Trump was going to win. But the Trump people, you know, they show up and, you know, that's you know, helps them in elections. It's the Trump people aren't apathetic. They're kind of fanatic. And we got to match that. Vicky Corden, Democrats do not want Greens, no labels or any third parties. Yep, that's true. They don't want competition. And as I pointed out many times, if you look at public opinion polls, the key green issues like Green New Deal, Medicare for All, tax the rich, are more popular than the Democrats' platform. They know that. They know that if we had equal footing in terms of proportional representation in elections to the legislature, public campaign finance, fair ballot access, we'd be taking a lot of seats that they want to take for granted. Andrew Hager. What about Nikki Haley? She does have a chance to beat Trump in the Republican ballot, or does she? Anything's possible, but it doesn't, in my opinion, look like she's going to do it. She could even win New Hampshire, but I'm not sure she's actually going to do that. She's just trying to beat DeSantis there at this point. Trump has got the base of the Republican Party, the hardcore that comes out and votes in primaries and shows up at caucuses. So I think Nikki Haley, she didn't draw a distinction between her and Trump that was strong. You know, she and all those other Republicans were saying, well, if Trump gets the nomination, I'll vote for him, except for Chris Christie. And, you know, he tried to draw a distinction, but he didn't catch on. I'm not sure there's the old, you know, moderate conservative Republican out there anymore. A lot of them have left the Republican Party. They're independent. Some of them are Democrats. They just don't have a home in the Republican Party, which has become an extreme right authoritarian party. Not a Barker. Here in Ohio, there's a grassroots movement to pass anti-gerrymandering legislation and focus on entering challengers in every uncontested local race there is, regardless of party or position, trying to break the stranglehold on our politics. Yeah, gerrymandering is a huge problem. It's the way the party with the plurality or slight majority magnifies their control by drawing the districts in a certain way. Like, I forget the exact numbers, but in Wisconsin, it's the Republicans got like 43% of the vote for state legislature, but by drawing the lines and controlling drawing the lines, they ended up with a, you know, 58% or something like that majority in the legislature. So gerrymandering is a terrible problem. The thing, you know, you can set up independent commissions to draw lines that are not biased toward one party or the other. But if we still have a single winner, winner take all districts, single member districts, you're going to get skewed. The majority or plurality is going to be magnified into a supermajority. That's just the way it works. So to really get rid of gerrymandering, we need proportional representation. So you're electing candidates from all the parties in multi-member districts in proportion to their vote. And then because it's proportional, where the lines are drawn doesn't make much difference. That is really the way to get rid of gerrymandering. And, you know, it's frustrating to me. I've been on a lot of forums where people are, you know, talking about fighting gerrymandering and, you know, the kind of voter suppression things that the Republicans are doing. And they won't take up proportional representation, even though ranked choice voting, including proportional ranked choice voting, is on a big winning streak. You know, 27 last ballot initiatives passed for RCV, ranked choice voting. That's a movement that's taken off, and I wish more progressives would get involved in it. And as far as challenging every race, regardless of party or position, I think we need a party on the left. You know, we should have a party with our candidates committed to our principles and not just support challengers, whatever their politics, just because so many of these races are uncontested. We should contest them with our own candidates and our own program. Richard Pink, is there a way to combine the campaigns of Cornel West, Jill Stein, and Claudia De La Cruz? I think there's a way Cornel West and Jill Stein can work together. Cornel is going to have a hell of a time getting on many ballots. He needs millions of dollars. I haven't seen his quarterly report, which was due at the beginning of this week. It still wasn't up when I looked on maybe Thursday night. But I doubt he's raised millions. Jill Stein has the Green Party, the organization she's raising. I would expect the kind of money that Cornel West is, you know, hundreds of thousands, not millions. But with our volunteers and some paid petitioners, we can get on the ballot in most states. So then, and Jill Stein has talked about this. She would offer the vice presidential position to Cornel West, which would fit him perfectly. I mean, his strength is public presentations to the media, to public meetings, and his weakness is organization and fundraising, running a presidential campaign. So they make a good combination. Claudia De La Cruz, I mean, she's the candidate of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. They're not out to build a mass base and impact the debate. They're out to recruit for their own sect. And they have, you know, terrible positions on international questions. You know, they're vulgar anti-imperialists. You know, to them, the only imperialism in the world is U.S. imperialism. And therefore, you know, Russia's invasion of Ukraine is, quote unquote, anti-imperialist. You know, the Kim dynasty in North Korea, the Assad dynasty in Syria, all these brutal right-wing governments, because they're in conflict with the U.S., they support. That's terrible politics. That's not going to be popular with the American people. So I don't think we want to have anything to do with PSL, Party for Socialism and Liberation, and their candidate. But I think and I hope that Cornel West will be Jill Stein's vice presidential candidate. I think that's a real possibility. Andrew Hager, I've heard that the Chinese president's been calling for a ceasefire. Have you heard anything about it for the articles to back their claims? A ceasefire where? In Gaza or Ukraine? On Ukraine, they did meet with Zelensky, and he's got a 10-point peace plan. The first time they had a meeting, the second time they stayed away. And, you know, some of the reports say the Russians discouraged them from continuing along those lines. You know, China has called for negotiations and I guess a ceasefire. But I don't see them, you know, really muscling in. They're posturing, not really using their strength. So I don't really look for much, you know, role for them in the Ukraine-Russia conflict. I'm not sure what articles to back their claims you might be referring to. As far as Gaza goes, I think China is calling for a ceasefire. They certainly have criticized in the UN resolutions Israel's assault on Gaza, which most of the world did except the US and a few of its minions, a handful, which are mostly Pacific Island nations that are pretty dependent on the US. And the UK, I guess, on the Gaza resolutions. Via email, response to the DOJ's Uvalde report. Man, I could hardly listen to those news stories about that. It's, you know, just imagining what those kids are going through while the cops are sitting out in the hallway, confused, not knowing what to do. It's just terrible. And, you know, there should be follow-up. I know the families of the victims want criminal charges against the people responsible for that, you know, terrible response to this shooting. And I hope they get that. I haven't read the report. I can hardly stomach reading about it because it's just so hard to think about those kids, you know, needing help and some of them bleeding out, some of them getting shot after the cops were there. It's just hard to take. Frankie Lee, Howie, what about Claudia De La Cruz being the only socialist and anti-capitalist candidate? This is where a lot of fed-up voters are. Yeah, nominally she's socialist and anti-capitalist, but I don't see how any socialist can support authoritarian police states like North Korea and Syria and Russia. She gives socialism a bad name by doing that. But because she labels herself a socialist, she's going to get some votes. So, It's just we need a real socialist movement, not one that's, I call it vulgar anti-imperialism. You know, they, whatever, if the U.S. is in conflict with anybody, they're going to support that anybody, no matter how authoritarian, capitalist, fascist, imperialist they are. It's a problem. We call it, another name for it is campism, where instead of having a class analysis of who's oppressed and who the oppressors are and siding with the oppressed, they have a geopolitical analysis of state interests. And so they're with whatever states are in conflict with the U.S., no matter how bad those states are. And that is not socialism. That's campism. Scout Trooper 164, I hear that Ukrainians are destroying Russian oil depots. Will likely affect the Russian battlefront and home front. Yeah, the Ukrainians are getting very good at destroying Russian military infrastructure with long-range drones, occasionally cruise missiles in Russian territory, but also in Crimea and southern Zaporizhia and Kherson Oblast. They took out, I guess it was three of Russia's very sophisticated jets, fighter jets that are better than the F-16s, which we said we're sending to Ukraine. They haven't got there yet. They also took out an AWACS and another intelligence plane. And this looks like it was done with the Patriot missile systems, which are very good anti-air air defense systems. It looks like they put them near the southern front and reached into the Azov Sea to do that. And then, you know, Ukraine has basically grounded the Russian naval fleet in the Black Sea with their boat drone strikes, and they sunk the flagship with a missile. So people say, well, Ukraine, it's a stalemate or it's a frozen conflict. Well, it's a frozen conflict for Russia, too. But if you look beyond the front lines, what's going on in the rear, Ukraine has made a lot of gains. So I think part of the rationale of people saying, oh, Ukraine can't win, it's losing. The next, you know, point is, therefore, they should negotiate, trade the land that Russia's taken from them for peace, which the Ukrainians don't believe will be peace because they did that before with the Minsk agreements and Russia violated them. Those were supposed to keep the front line frozen after Russia took the eastern Donbass and Crimea. So, you know, I think the point I get from what you're saying is, you know, Ukraine is still fighting. The problem is they're running out of air defense missiles, Patriot missiles, ammunition shells, because the EU delayed, but it looks like they're $55 million in aid, which is mostly economic aid is going through. And then the $61 billion, about $40 billion, which is military aid, is stuck in the House because the far-right Republicans are holding that hostage to their immigration reform. And that's going to hurt Ukraine if they can't defend themselves. They don't have basic artillery shells and air defense missiles. Russia's going to bomb the hell out of them with their missiles and drones, and they're going to be able to advance on the front line because Ukraine won't be able to fire back. So I guess I'm saying Ukraine is getting its blows in, but they can't if they don't have the weapons they need. And that's where it's at. It's a fluid situation. It's not a stalemate that won't change, I guess. It's going to change one way or the other. But it may take a while. Scout Trooper 164, Russia will suffer more in the winter with oil and gas gone. They can't refuel tanks, can't replenish heat or stoves. It will worsen things. Yeah, they're going to suffer like the Ukrainians suffered last winter, and they are in some places this winter. It looks like some of the problems in Russia are just poor maintenance of their infrastructure. There are areas of Moscow that are without heat, is district heating, and the district heating systems have gone kaput. So that's a self-inflicted wound on the part of Russia, which has not been investing in their infrastructure or the social needs of their people. And now they've shifted to a war economy where that's not going to be a priority either. But I wouldn't overestimate how difficult it's going to be for Russia to get fuel. I mean, the countries are awash in oil and gas. They have plenty of sources. What Ukraine is doing is making it logistically harder, but I don't think it's going to stop fuel for their tanks or, heat and gas for their cooking. Andrew Hager, I sure hope Edward Snowden will be okay. Yeah, I wonder about him. I said during the 2020 campaign that if I was president, I would, drop the charges against him, bring him home, and see if he wanted to advise on how to have an open information system while also providing security for those that information which should be a secret. I think he knows what he's doing, and I think he has a good approach to it in terms of values and legal framework. And he's kind of a libertarian kind of guy politically. So I don't think he's happy in Russia. He kind of got stuck there, and he's become a Russian citizen because he's now has a child there. That gets the child into schools and so forth. But I think if he could come back and not face legal consequences, he would. In fact, he said if he could actually testify. See, he's under indictment under the Patriot Act, that act after World War I that they're going after Assange with too. I forget the name of it, but you can't defend yourself on political grounds or security grounds under that law. So it's really repressive. He said he'd be willing to go to court and defend himself if he could. So anyway, yeah, I hope he'll be okay too. The Espionage Act of 1918 is the act that he's charged under. The email comments on the set debt ceiling deal. I guess you're referring to the continuing resolution, which keeps the government funded until sometime in March. So what, 6 weeks, 7 weeks? They're going to address all this stuff again. It'll be another opportunity for the Republicans to throw, wrenches into the works and try to make, Biden and the Democrats look bad. If people are paying attention, it should make the Republicans look bad. But most people don't look at, how this came about. They just look at the fact that it did come about. And since Biden is the president, the Republicans hope he'll get blamed. The email, thoughts on the federal government seeking the death penalty against the Buffalo mass shooter. I'm against the death penalty. That guy, should rot in prison for the rest of his life. That's, I think the punishment. The problem with the death penalty is too many people are convicted and they turn out to be innocent. I think it's pretty clear this guy did it. But I'm just opposed to the death penalty. I think it's immoral. Don't do what he did to him. Take the high road, and his punishment should be life imprisonment, not the death penalty. Violated Content Boutique. Howie, have you been snowed in this last week? That cold sounds nasty. Try Mir tea and capsules. I don't know what that is. I got green tea with honey and lemon, and that's a home remedy. I used to like to get a cold when I was a kid because I got to drink this. So that's pretty good. I mean, it soothes my throat, although I do have that cold, that cough. We didn't get a whole lot of snow. That was Buffalo because of the way the wind blew. It was blowing basically west to east. So Buffalo gets it off the lake. The lake at Syracuse is near, it goes north. Now the wind is coming more from the north, and it's snowing right now. We've had lake effect, you know, all afternoon. So we're not supposed to. I mean, the forecast didn't forecast this, but we got a lake effect band blowing snow into Syracuse right now. Richard Pink. The USA has at least one private air force which is outsourced to train the USA Air Force with Soviet era jet fighters. Our official Air Force is also in possession of a number of Soviet era jet fighters. Why hasn't Joe Biden sent these fighters to Ukraine? Isn't this an indication our government really doesn't want Ukraine to win? Ukraine has already lost a whole generation of young men. When will this end? I don't know about the Soviet-era fighter jets the U.S. may have. I just don't know. But I think it is a question that Joe Biden needs to answer, is why he's been so slow to send the weapons that Ukraine needs to defend itself. I mean, they had the intelligence. They were broadcasting it to the world that the Russians were going to invade Ukraine. They did that for 3 months before the invasion actually happened. Their intelligence, they pretty much pinned it down to the day when it happened. But instead of sending Ukraine weapons to defend itself, Biden offered, you know, to help Zelensky set up a government in exile. And at the last minute, they sent him 80 javelins, you know, which are anti-tank weapons. You know, that was token. Now, the Ukrainians had some more they'd gotten sooner, earlier, but, you know, the U.S. hadn't really armed Ukraine. And, you know, Putin saying, oh, NATO's coming. But, you know, Ukraine, since 2008, when George W. Bush proposed it, had never even got a membership action plan. NATO doesn't want Ukraine because then they'd have to go way east to defend NATO, and they just don't want to do that. They don't want to get Ukraine in until everything's settled. And then we had, you know, the Ukrainians said, send us tanks. Well, it took a year. They said, send us the Patriot air defense systems. And they didn't get it till April of 2023, after Russia had bombed their energy infrastructure all winter. The F-16s, you know, Biden was saying no, 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 and finally yes, but they still haven't arrived. You know, the Ukrainian pilots have been undergoing training, but as far as we know, they still haven't got there. And now we're in a situation where they don't have, you know, artillery rounds, and they're running out of air defense missiles. So I think, you know, it is a reasonable question. You know, our government really doesn't want Ukraine to win. They don't want Ukraine to lose. They want to see it fought to a standstill and then a deal cut. And there are a lot of people in the foreign policy elite, you know, Richard Haass, who was president of the Council on Foreign Relations and advisor to presidents for many decades, is among those. And so I think that's, you know, the problem with U.S. policy is, you know, NATO, you know, they haven't really given Ukraine what it needs to push the Russians out of their country. Now, Ukraine has lost a whole generation of young men. They've lost a generation of middle-aged men. The average age of a Ukrainian soldier is 40. They have guys in their 50s and 60s fighting on the front line. They've avoided drafting their young. The draft age is 27, I believe. And they haven't done that much drafting. They had so many volunteers at the beginning. So I'm saying the young generation is there, but now they're talking about expanding the draft, lowering the age of conscription. And then the question, where will this end? That's hard to say. I see a prolonged struggle because Ukraine does not want to have their people come under Russian rule. we can see what's been going on in, you know, the Donbass, Oblast, Luhansk, and Donetsk, most of the Ukrainian, ethnic Ukrainians, and many of the ethnic Russians, and, you know, all of them are Russian speakers in that part of the country, have left. Those two oblasts are depopulated because the Russians are so repressive. And now in Zaporizhia and Kherson, you know, we have a lot of reports, particularly the part of Kherson that Ukraine liberated last fall, a year ago, fall, you know, torture. They have this filtration process. And if they don't think you're loyal to Russia, they'll detain you, torture you, sexual harassment and abuse of women and sometimes men. And then the children, you know, they take the children and deport them to Russia. I mean, that's why the International Criminal Court has an arrest warrant out for Putin and his children's rights commissioner, Maria Lvova-Belova. I mean, it's terrible. The Ukrainians see that, and they're not going to give up land to the Russians. They don't want to live under that. So they're not going to give up. The Russians, on the other hand, what are they fighting for? They're fighting because Putin tells them to fight. You had this week in the Bashkir people in Bashkirstan. I think I'm pronouncing that right. They are a people at the southern end of the Urals near Kazakhstan. And one of their activists who has been opposing mines in their area on ecological grounds and promoting their language and cultural heritage, he was sentenced to 4 years. And thousands of people came out to protest. And they had, you know, protests and confrontations with Russian police forces all this week. So you wonder, you know, how much of that opposition is under the surface, because it's, you know, very repressive. I mean, you say anything critical of the war, even call it a war, and you'll be accused of discrediting the Russian army and can be sent away to prison for 5 to 7 years. There are like 20,000 people who receive those kind of sentences. So I hope it ends with Russia deciding to cut their losses and get the hell out of Ukraine. But whether that can happen with Putin still in charge, and even if he goes, there's, you know, this Russian ultra-nationalist, imperialist current in Russian politics in the elites. So they may continue. It's a terrible situation, and it's a threat to world peace. There's, you know, Europe has a lot of concern. They're going to go after the Baltic states, Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia next, or Moldova. So I can't tell you where it will end. But I think, you know, that we should realize, you know, we're on the side of the people who are the victims of this assault, this aggression, and, you know, support them. Okay, well, thanks everybody for coming today. I'm sorry I had problems with, you know, coughing with this cold. Hopefully by next week it'll be cleared up, and I won't be coughing in your face. And we'll be back here next week, same time. And there's plenty of news to talk about. So I hope you'll make it again next week. Have a good week.